I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Hey there, Macro Data Refiners. Long time no elevator ride. So good to see you've decided to join me for this special edition of Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. Since we're in a holding pattern due to the Writers Guild of America strike, WGA strong, I've been looking for things to keep us all busy. Idle hands on the severed floor usually lead to break room visits, and no one wants that. Since we might not be seeing a new episode of Severance for several months, I decided to look into some of the things that influenced Dan Erickson and the Severance writing and creative team as they were developing the series. This is something I'm calling Severed Origins. One of the properties most often name-checked in interviews is a novella by Philip K. Dick called Paycheck. It was originally written in 1952. The premise was updated and made into a 2003 movie starring Ben Affleck, Aaron Eckhart, Uma Thurman, and Paul Giamatti. I've both read the novella and watched the movie. I thought it might be fun and interesting to see what parts of Paycheck may have influenced what we're seeing in Severance. As usual, huge spoilers for both the movie and the novella. If you haven't seen the movie or read the book and you want to be surprised, you'd better stop this podcast right now. The movie intertwines many of the original ideas from the novella with director John Woo's outrageous action set pieces. Wu is the Hong Kong wild man who's given us such action classics as Hard Target, Broken Arrow, Face Off, and Mission Impossible 2. Nothing explodes and no dubs were released in the novella. I guarantee you a lot of stuff explodes in the movie with at least one dub, and of course, motorcycles. Not sure why, but John Woo loves to put people on motorcycles. So, refiners, I thought it might be interesting to take a look at this very creative, very tortured guy named Philip K. Dick. Referred to as PKD by his fans, Dick was a huge force in 20th century sci-fi. His creation, Paycheck, contains foundational ideas which inspired Severance. So, refiners, if you're ready, boot up your workstations. It's time to take a look at the file called Paycheck, both the movie and the original novella. First off, who is Philip K. Dick? A lot of folks believe the 30-foot relief sculpture of Keir Egan in the Lumen Atrium is an homage to PKD.
I love seeing the sunrise on his face.
I'd say the sculpture theory is a stretch, but Dick's impact on Severance cannot be overstated. The themes of his stories have not only had a huge impact on Severance, they've also influenced society. Dick's stories have been the basis for some of our most popular science fiction movies, like Blade Runner and Total Recall. Here's a fun cocktail party factoid about Mr. Dick. The K stands for Kindred, which was his mother's maiden name. Philip K. Dick was born in Chicago in December of 1928. He was a twin, born 6 weeks premature, along with his sister named Jane Charlotte. Jane only survived about 6 weeks after their birth. Knowledge of her death would affect Dick throughout his life, leading to a recurring theme of the phantom twin in many of his stories. If knowing his twin had died wasn't enough to mess with his head, I think the way his parents handled her interment was a bit ghoulish. Baby Jane's tombstone was inscribed with both names, Jane and her brother Philip. Imagine seeing your own name and date of birth on a tombstone as a child. Philip would eventually be buried alongside her 53 years later. While Philip was still a toddler, the family relocated to San Francisco. Dick name-checks SF in many of his stories, including Paycheck. When he was 5, Dick's father was transferred to Reno, Nevada. His mother, Dorothy, did not want to move again. She was so adamant about not going to Reno, she divorced Joseph. Both fought for custody of Philip, but it was awarded to Dorothy. Determined to raise her son as a single mother, Dorothy and Philip relocated to Washington, D.C. Philip attended elementary school for 2 years in Washington before his mother once again moved them back to California. Interestingly, his elementary teacher in D.C. gave him a C in written composition, but she did say he had a strong interest and ability when it came to storytelling. Philip attended Berkeley High School in Berkeley, California, where he graduated in 1947. He started working at a local record store located on Telegraph Avenue right out of high school. Dick briefly attended college. He went to UC Berkeley for about 2 months. He enrolled in September of 1949 and had dropped out by November 11th of 1949. He didn't declare a major, but he did take a few classes in psychology and philosophy. His exposure to philosophy, although brief, was enough to mess with his perceptions for the rest of his life. He said he believed existence is based on internal human perception, which does not always necessarily correspond to external reality. He continued his philosophical studies even after leaving UC Berkeley. He came to the personal conclusion that in many ways the world is not entirely real. Because we are limited to our perceptions of the world by our senses, we don't really have an unbiased method to confirm what's truly even there. Dick's work reflected this idea. We don't really know reality. We can't. We are limited by our senses, our perceptions, and of course, our memories. In Dick's world, our senses are unreliable witnesses to what's going on around us. Memory is even more fickle. The story, "We Can Remember It For You Wholesale," became the basis for the 1990 Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Total Recall. In it, a man wants to have the experience of having been to Mars implanted in his memories. This is something commercially available in the future of the story. Why actually go through the danger and expense of experiencing something when you can have memories of the experience implanted in your brain for a whole lot less? Even if you never did whatever it was, having the memory implanted in your brain makes you truly believe you did it. As he's being prepped for this routine procedure, it's discovered he's already really been to Mars. Not only that, we find our hero was in reality an assassin who had committed murder on Mars. Since his prior memory of his Martian adventures had been wiped, he had no clue. Oh, and again, spoilers are everywhere in this podcast. If you have not yet gotten around to watching the 33-year-old Total Recall, you still probably should, even with the spoiler, if for nothing else, to check out the three-breasted prostitute. Although even her legacy has been sullied over the years, it was reported in a 2012 interview that all three of her breasts were prosthetics for more than 25 years. The world believed only the middle one was foam rubber. Oh, and this prosthetic boob info came to light in 2012 because that was the year of the Colin Farrell Total Recall reboot. Avoid this one like the plague. In an outlandishly weasel move, the new movie only listed the previous movie as inspiration. They did mention We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, but they did not give PKD writing credit on the 2012 movie, even though he came up with the whole idea in the first place. I encourage you to register your disgust with this move on Rotten Tomatoes. Paycheck is a very early Philip K. Dick story, which also uses the plot device of wiped or altered memories. He was only 23 when he began writing it in July of 1952. This was right about the time he decided he was going to be a writer full-time and gave up the job at the record store on Telegraph Avenue. Paycheck was first published in the June 1953 issue of Imagination magazine. The 50s were a lean and impoverished time for Dick. He was regularly selling stories to pulp sci-fi magazines, but the paychecks were meager. He once said of the era, "We couldn't even pay late fees on a library book." The 60s were a bit brighter for Dick's career, at least when it came to fame. He did win the Hugo Award in 1963 for The Man in the High Castle, and yes, this is the story that is the basis for the Amazon Prime video series of the same name. The show is produced by Ridley Scott, but also by Electric Shepherd Productions, the production company owned and operated by Dick's estate. Even with increased fame and more awareness of his work, Dick was still relegated to publishing his stuff through the low-paying science fiction genre publishers. Although his ideas are groundbreaking, he would never realize great riches from his writing. Dick battled addictions and suffered from mental health issues throughout his life. He said anxiety was a key reason for dropping out of college. He also attempted suicide on more than one occasion. The mental health problems may have stemmed from his nearly lifelong drug use. Dick was a dedicated speed freak throughout the 50s, 60s, and much of the 70s. Actually, he's quoted in a Rolling Stone interview as saying the novel A Scanner Darkly from 1977 was the first thing he'd ever written without being on speed. And yes, that's the story the 2006 Keanu Reeves Winona Ryder movie is based on. Philip K. Dick died from brain death caused by two back-to-back strokes in 1982. He was only 53 years old. Although it wasn't listed as a cause of death, a lifetime of amphetamine use certainly had to have taken a toll on his circulatory system. Although his written stories never brought him huge wealth or fame, the movies made based on his stories had generated more than $1 billion in box office as of 2009, and we're still making things based on his work. He died just 4 months before the release of the huge hit movie based on his short story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Not a familiar title? Well, it's because they changed it. Dick claimed he was lousy with titles. He said they would be so bad, sometimes his editors would change whatever he came up with. The movie made from the Electric Sheep story was the 1982 sci-fi masterpiece, Blade Runner. I mentioned Total Recall from 1990, the 2002 Steven Spielberg thriller Minority Report starring Tom Cruise was also from a Dick story. With that one, they kept the original title. The Adjustment Bureau from 2011 starring Matt Damon came from the short story Adjustment Team. Dick's recurring themes touched on the fragile nature of what we perceive as real and what makes up personal identity. Sound familiar? Our intrepid macrodats have to be wondering what's real and what exactly constitutes personal identity, especially now that they've experienced a taste of outie life. So that's a quick look at Philip K. Dick, the man behind many of the big ideas in Severance and in modern sci-fi. If you'd like to know more about him, make sure to find Lawrence Sutton's 1989 biography called Divine Invasions, A Life of Philip K. Dick. Now, let's talk about Paycheck. The basic story of Paycheck is about Jennings, a man his employer refers to as a mechanic, but he's really more of an electronics engineer. In the movie, Ben Affleck portrays Jennings, who's given the first name Michael. In the novella, we first meet Jennings at the end of a two-year project he's completed for a place called Rethrick Construction. He has absolutely no memory of the entire 2 years. He agreed to have that period wiped from his brain as a part of his employment. It is implied in the story this brain wipe after a sensitive project is a common practice among tech firms. The brain wipe procedure, much like Severance, has become the ultimate non-disclosure agreement. You can't tell anyone secrets about what you were working on if you have no idea what you were working on. We don't get any details as to how this mind wipe works in the novella, but it does seem to work very well. Jennings originally signed his contract for what we're told is a huge amount of money. In the book, it's 50,000 credits. We don't know what a credit's worth, but Jennings is bowled over even considering this amount. In the film, Michael Jennings goes for the more traditional U.S. dollar option. He winds up getting right around $92 million for his 3 years' worth of work. Yeah, just to give it their own stamp, the filmmakers extended Jennings' project by another year. When Jennings in the book gets to the paymaster, as he calls a character named Kelly, she tells him he recently changed his contract. Jennings, of course, does not remember because he made that decision to change during the period when he was wiped. He has to admit it's his signature authorizing the contract revision. According to the revision, he will forego the big payday, and instead, he wants to be paid with a bag full of trinkets. He signed off on everything prior to being wiped. Of course, he now has no memory of making this bizarre decision. He's wondering if he's either crazy or being ripped off. The items are an assortment of odds and ends that don't mean anything to the newly wiped Jennings. Many of the ideas in Paycheck are groundbreaking, but since the story was written in 1952, many of them are also laughably quaint. Even though the story is set well into the future, many advances are reflections of what was happening in the early 50s. One I particularly enjoyed was the cigarette with a push-button lighter built in. He didn't go into great detail about this one, but I got an image immediately. This was at a time when more than half of all adults in the U.S. smoked. Predicting advances in cigarette lighting technology would have seemed smart in 1952. It truly was an era of huge advances with no end in sight. Plastics were being introduced for home use, radio was coast to coast, and television was starting to catch on. About 1 in 10 homes actually had one. Travel was also experiencing huge advances at this time. Commercial air travel had been around since the mid-1920s, but it was limited, expensive, and a bit scary. Access to longer routes carrying more air passengers in relative comfort was just becoming viable for many people in the early 1950s. Trains were the dominant means of travel in the United States at the time. Air travel didn't officially surpass trains in total number of passengers until 1955. The speed and power of the jet engine would not be added to commercial air travel until 1958. So Dick was writing at a time before jet planes, Sputnik, the Mercury Project. He was well before Apollo. Manned spaceflight was a sci-fi writer's dream. Even though the big U.S. aerospace programs wouldn't happen until later, we were in the throes of rocket lust in the 1940s and 50s. World War II had introduced working rockets as weapons. In the aftermath of the war, our rocket development continued. We were developing rockets as weapons, like the ICBM, but we were also looking to rockets as a mode of transportation. The U.S. had stolen away German rocket scientists like Wernher von Braun, the father of space travel. We loved rockets. We just didn't completely understand how exactly they could be used or if they could be reused. Not surprising, in the novella, the primary mode of long-distance transportation is not by jet plane, but by rocket. The rocket ports sound a little like airports, but really more like bus stations. Short trips are handled by robot-piloted jet-powered cruisers. Some private citizens also seem to own these cruisers. Buses are jet-powered with a robot conductor who still comes around to collect bus tokens. The movie scriptwriters and John Woo both decided to skip a lot of Dick's futuristic developments. The movie sticks with the central story idea, but opts for more familiar cars, buses, and planes in the screen version of Paycheck. Dick's narrative begins the minute after Jennings has had his memories removed. He talks about how he knows where he is, but it was late fall when he last remembers being here. Now it's spring, more than 2 years later. Just like riding the severed elevator, to Jennings' perception, the time jump feels like a moment ago. For the movie, somebody decided we needed a primer to ease us into what's happening. It's a ritual that's become the standard structure for movies where we're introduced to either a new technology or a new job class. In this case, we're getting a little of both. Since we don't have access to his internal monologue the way we do in the book, we have to watch Jennings in action in order to understand what it is he does. Since the movie adds a prologue we don't get in the book, we'll start with the movie narrative. We open on Ben Affleck as Michael Jennings. He's dressed in a nice suit and sunglasses, hanging out at what appears to be a mildly futuristic consumer electronics show. The hot new item is a monitor that can present a subject in 3D. The model doing the demo appears to be sticking her head through the monitor bezel like it's a window. Jennings' job? Reverse engineer this little marvel and figure out how they did it. Improve it if you can, sure, but for the most part, we just want you to rip it off so we can build our own version. He has 2 months to do the job. Yes, in the novella, the job lasts 2 years. This isn't that job. We'll get to the 2-year project, which has become a 3-year project, just not yet. This 2-month project is our primer, teaching us how these jobs Jennings does are usually supposed to work. After picking up a monitor to be disassembled, Jennings is placed in a high-tech workshop. He gets right to work. He barely takes off his suit coat and loosens his tie before he starts ripping the monitor apart. This is where Paycheck and Severance diverge. The guy doing the work on the monitor essentially becomes Jennings' innie. He doesn't switch to a new persona, but when he's done, he won't remember anything about the work this guy did. In the book, Dick even references the person who did the work, but then had those memories wiped as he in italics, like it's another person. The big difference? This innie is a one-off. He will never exist again, so he doesn't get rebellious. All of Jennings' innies are one time only. The memories aren't bifurcated and maintained the way they are on Severance. There's only one timeline, but these innie memories are completely ripped from the worker's mind at the end of each job. It would be a little like running a clean slate on the macrodats at the end of each quarter, if a clean slate is what we understand it to be. The 2 months slip by in a few seconds. At the end of it, the brilliant Jennings has not only copied the tech, he's even allowed the subject to be freestanding and fully 3D. No more Monitor Beazel.
You understand, Mr. Jennings. You've just done in 2 months what we've been trying to do for 3 years.
And without getting too deeply into it, this monitor tech is as magical and currently as impossible as everything else in the movie. After the big product reveal, Rita, the blonde company attorney with the smoky eyes, decides she sees an opening. The room clears and she goes about seducing the tall and handsome Mr. Jennings, even though we aren't sure if he's even had a shower in the last 2 months. They have a PG-level steamy encounter right there on his workbench. This may not be Rita's first time molesting the severed workers, the NDA workers. She jokes with him about it.
You won't remember me, will you?
No.
That's too bad.
We then get a killer transition which sucks us into an insane John Woo montage. Tons of images are ripping by, mostly things we've already seen. We're in Jennings' brain, and his memories are being erased. This is where we meet a new character played by Paul Giamatti. He's Jennings' brain handler, his mind wiper. Later, he calls himself the guy who does everything for you. A quick aside about Mr. Giamatti. I'm a huge fan. He's a national treasure. This part was back before Sideways. Sideways was that little wine-tasting movie from 2004 starring Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church. It went on to make more than $100 million at the box office, won an Oscar for scriptwriting, and was nominated for Best Picture. Sideways took Paul Giamatti from being a one-episode day player and movie sidekick, much like he is here, to being Paul Giamatti, serious actor. Sure, he'd still do the occasional video game voice and a couple of episodes of Inside Amy Schumer, but after Sideways, he was a recognizable star. Want to revel in maximum Giamatti? Sure, you could binge 70-plus episodes of Billions, but I'd rather you check out the 7-episode John Adams miniseries from 2008. As I said, national treasure.
Marker reached.
It's fun to see him here being all serious and techy as a sidekick named Shorty. He doesn't even get a last name. He's just Shorty. This is a character created for the movie. PKD's story doesn't really get into the actual mind wiping. He assumes the tech works and picks up after the wipe.
Okay. We're now extracting his memory from the marker forward to the present.
In the book, the mind wipe seems to be a surgical procedure. At the time of its writing, there were no desktop computers, monitors, or even video games to call on as the blueprint for tools which might even be used in brain resurfacing. Dick does give us one mention of a wedge cut out of Jennings' brain. He has a hard spot where it was taken from behind his ear. Other than that, there's no novella description of what happens during the selective mind wipe. In the movie, Giamatti's character appears to be playing a video game. On the computer screen are tiny green nodules in a web. To the movie, these nodules are little packets of memory. He's focusing in on each nodule and, for want of a better word, blasting them off the screen. The script treats memory as a linear thing. We see Giamatti tracking the packets of memory back along a line. He's looking for a marker in the linear thread of images, which indicates where the memory sequence began. He's blasting away the past 2 months of memories. This movie is okay. It's not great. On Rotten Tomatoes, critics are giving it a 27%, viewers a 45%. On IMDb, it's got a 6.3 out of 10, so an F. I don't know if it's that bad, but here's one of the many little reasons why it's not great. As we go through this mind wipe procedure, there's a monitor next to Affleck's chair. It's showing video of his memories, just like Giamatti was fast reversing through a DVD. I'd maybe buy that if what we were looking at were believably Jennings' memories. There's no way they could be. Each memory is looking at Jennings from a third-party vantage point. When have you ever had a memory of anything where you were watching yourself like you were on TV? Even if you're as movie star handsome as Affleck, your memories are going to be from the first-person point of view. What Giamatti's clearing are the images Wu shot for the previous scenes, and they are all from the viewer's perspective. If these were really Jennings' memories, we'd be seeing a point-of-view shot out of his eyes. Images flash by. Attorney Rita can be seen in one of the glimpses, only now she's stripped down to her bra and being lifted up on the work table.
Jesus, Rita.
This is not an image we saw previously, but it is still being shown to us from a third-party point of view, and it's still very PG. John Woo is all about pornographic violence, but not real porn. There's a temperature readout on Giamatti's monitor. It starts at 37 and is rising as he blasts away bits of memory. To the entirely non-metric U.S., 37 doesn't mean a thing. To the rest of the world, 37 degrees Celsius is normal human body temperature. One of the platoon of suits standing around the room during the procedure bumps the workstation.
Jesus Christ! This is dangerous enough!
For some reason, this causes the temp to jump up. It seems awfully touchy to be that important. We then get this little bit of first act information.
If this man's brain temp goes 1C above 43, he's a veg.
Thankfully, veg is not a term which caught on for the description of brain dead patients. Giamatti gets control enough to bring the temp down, and Jennings is not rendered a veg. If he were, this would be a pretty short movie. So what's with 43 as a hard target? It's like having a fever. With the most basic amount of searching, I was able to discover a human can survive with a brain temperature of 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 degrees Fahrenheit. It's high, but well below veg temps. At 104 degrees, the blood-brain barrier does begin to break down, but a patient would not experience brain damage. Doctors say 108 degrees Fahrenheit, or 42 degrees Celsius, is the threshold for actual brain damage in a patient with a severe fever. At 43 degrees C, yeah, Shorty's right. He's going to be fried. The thing for us as the viewer is to mark this bit of internal movie information. You can rest assured if we're given this oh-so-damaging number in the first act, and they do really put a spotlight on it, you know it's going to be called back later in the movie. We need to remember 43 is the number to stay under. Giamatti blasts away the past 2 months. After he finds the initial marker, he asks the last date Jennings remembers.
October 19th.
Very good.
A quick glance at a conveniently placed wall calendar tells us it's actually now December 22nd. The procedure worked. Jennings then gets to the real meat of the matter.
I never worked here. I never saw anybody. I never was here. I got it. Is my paycheck ready?
We get a glimpse of the two-month payday as he rips open the envelope. There are no credits or odd monetary devices presented. He's looking at a check for just over $500,000 of what appear to be good old U.S. dollars. Actually, it's for $526,000.39. The 39 cents made me chuckle.
Alrighty.
Wu and the scriptwriters have dumped a huge part of Dick's story when it comes to the politics of the U.S. In the second paragraph of the novella, we're told the government, which was in power when Jennings started his two-year project, had fallen. A new, more restrictive government had arisen in its place. They have a more aggressive secret police force, or SP. And, for some reason, the new regime is also filling in the San Francisco Bay, possibly to create more space for housing in San Francisco. Even with the change in power, the credit system for money and most of the underlying support systems of society seem to have remained intact. It must have been a fairly bloodless coup. We discover in the book, corporations like Rethrick Construction have become huge bastions of protection from the government for their employees. There's a power struggle happening between these massive corporations and the officials trying to control them. In the book, one of the key reasons the secret police have apprehended the newly wiped Jennings is to discover the location of Rethrick's plant. The SP knows Jennings was working at the plant. They want him to give them a location. Unfortunately, the location of his work was ripped out of his mind along with everything else. The government thinks Rethrick is doing something illegal, but Rethrick is so huge and shadowy, they're able to effectively hide the location of their massive research and development bunker. Tracking political upheaval and reporting on government oversight does not make for a great action movie. Sure, it makes for a good sci-fi premise, but none of it is very visual or viscerally exciting. PKD seemed to want to delve into major societal issues. Jennings even mentions how the new regime sounds a lot like communism, which he says had been a scourge back in the mid-20th century. Instead of making government the bad guy, the movie takes an equally easy route, making giant corporations the bad guys. In the movie, government and societal support structures seem to be humming along as usual without major changes. It might be a few years in the future, but we recognize this world and we understand it as viewers. It's just easier that way for the filmmaker. A bus is a bus, a car is a car, and a dollar is a dollar. John Woo doesn't have to worry about coming up with exotic new forms of any of it. He instead would like to blow up a few of the current modes of transportation and race the ones that survive at breakneck speeds throughout town. Jennings is paid, so we're done with the monitor guys. Affleck and Giamatti are now in a modern gym-looking area. Jennings' post-brainwipe regimen includes some kind of Jedi workout with a stick and buzzing targets.
How you feeling, Tiger?
Oh, good.
Now let's hear you. Ready? Go!
Gotta keep what's left of Jennings' brain sharp, I guess. This scene is really all about Sweaty Ben in a tank top. Affleck and Giamatti do have a great post-workout scene. Jennings is drinking some gross health smoothie at the gym juice bar. Shorty is fascinated by Jennings' complete lack of concern about losing the last 2 months. Jennings delivers a monologue strangely reminiscent of Mark's excuses for his severed existence.
You know, the last thing I remember is driving in Spain in the Aston Martin. Learned to dive in Belize with, what's her name? A 7 stadiums in 7 days trip. It's great. I mean, my memories are basically highlights. It's good. It's a good life. Stuff you erase, doesn't matter.
When you're living that severed life, you've got to keep convincing yourself it's the right thing to do. Jennings goes home to an empty apartment. This whole scene feels a little like episode 1 when Mark went home to his empty apartment. Since this is Ben Affleck, there is, of course, a Boston reference. The last thing of any importance he remembers from October 19th is the Red Sox making the playoffs. So maybe this movie isn't so futuristic after all. In 2003, the Red Sox did make the playoffs but lost the AL Championship Series. In 2004, the Red Sox would go on to win the World Series for the first time since 1918. Of course, Affleck/Jennings has all the playoff games he missed on videotape. And, videotape? Not even the newly introduced TiVo? Okay, so the tech is dating this movie big time. He immediately starts watching the games, catching up on what he missed. As he's watching, he goes through the mail that piled up in his absence. He opens a rich-looking envelope. There's a card emblazoned with gold leaf, and the names James and Sarah Rethrick. Rethrick. Now we're getting into novella territory. The card is a party invitation. It also contains a newspaper clipping about the introduction of Nexum's hot new 3D monitor, the one Jennings had helped create. There's a handwritten note from what must be James Rethrick. It's signed simply Jimmy. He knows Jennings is back home, so there's no excuse for missing his party. Oh, and he also adds a P.S. Boston lost. Spoiler alert, Jimmy! We cut to a lavish affair. Giamatti and Affleck are cruising the room in nice suits.
What is it with guys like Rethrick? He's gotta have everything, huh?
Well, Say what you want about Jimmy. He started Alcom in his garage.
It would be hard to make any friends or maintain a social life when you regularly disappear for weeks at a time. Shorty seems to be Jennings' only friend, but Michael makes a lousy date. He's aggressively catching the eye of each lovely lady that passes. As he's doing this, we suddenly get a glimpse of Uma Eyes. This movie has some big names in it. Yes, that's another Boston native, Uma Thurman, smiling seductively at Mr. Boston, Ben Affleck. Uma is playing the character of Rachel. This is Uma in the midst of Tarantino corruption. As soon as I saw her, I thought she had the overly glossed lips and floppy, willowy bangs of a Kill Bill movie. I could not have been more spot on. Kill Bill Volume 1 had just come out earlier this year, and Kill Bill 2 would be coming out the next year in 2004. This is Uma catching a breather between bouts of brutal fighting and bloodshed for a little more brutal fighting and bloodshed. The difference here, she's more of an observer, not the one doing the fighting. She is, of course, mysterious and alluring. Jennings is instantly drawn to her, leaving his good buddy Shorty alone at the Rethrick party to mingle.
I don't want to mingle.
Uma, as we'll later discover, is a doctor of biology at Rethrick's company. They made some needed updates here. It's acknowledged that Rethrick is the founder, but we're told the company is Alcom. The practice of putting a family name on a huge multinational corporation had started to fall out of favor along about the 1970s. Microsoft could have easily been Gates Industries in the same vein as Ford Motor Company, Procter & Gamble, or Johnson & Johnson. But those were named in a different time. Rethrick is the name on the company in the novella, but not here. In a nice twist, Rethrick is the owner, founder, and CEO, but the company name is the very generic Alcom. Uma's character is also not in the novella. In 1952, Dick would have never made a woman something so important as a researcher at a mega corporation. Instead, the femme fatale who assists Jennings in the book is Kelly, the secretary who originally gave Jennings his envelope of stuff. There had been a surge in female employment during and after World War II. It would mirror society in the early 50s to have a woman in the workplace, but not in a high-paying or important job. Except for a few rare instances, female employees of the era worked in support positions like secretaries, stenographers, and executive assistants. Kelly is just as instrumental and important to the story as Uma's Rachel character, but unlike Rachel, Kelly had little to no clout at the company. There's an awkward and clunky meeting between Michael and Rachel. She's alarmingly quick to admit she's a biologist who works on top secret projects at Alcom. Michael, well, he's a pig.
Let's go.
Excuse me?
I mean, I'm happy to continue blathering on, trying helplessly to charm you, but I thought maybe, you know, cut to the chase and just, go somewhere.
Ugh. And he just had the throwdown with attorney Rita earlier today. Getting a mind wipe must make you horny.
I'll tell you what, Michael. I'm gonna walk over there and talk to a friend of mine. If you get the urge to have a real conversation, you'll know where to find me.
Rachel handles herself well, putting Mr. J in his place, but this whole scene was pretty hard to watch.
Mike! Jimmy!
How you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Good to see you.
You too, you look good.
As soon as Uma exits, another high-powered, recognizable star enters the scene. It's Aaron Eckhart. He's playing James Jimmy Rethrick, founder and CEO of Alcom, and former classmate of Jennings. Like Giamatti, this is a year or two before Eckhart would really break through with his stellar turn in Thank You for Smoking. That came out in 2005, then in 2008... He starred as Harvey Dent, Two-Face, in Christopher Nolan's blockbuster Dark Knight. Paycheck's tally of good-looking alpha males goes up by one. Make no mistake, the testosterone is thick in this movie, and we haven't even met Michael C. Hall's character yet. Jennings and Rethrick adjourn to Rethrick's office. Cigars are preferred. Affleck takes one, but his baby face does not look natural with a cigar sticking out of it. Rethrick, it seems, has invented Alexa about 7 or 8 years before Jeff Bezos would steal her from a Polish inventor.
Isaac, disable fire protection, please.
Alarm?
disabled.
Well, sure, the cigars would set off the fire alarm. The light on the alarm goes out. In a haze of cigar smoke, Rethrick tells Jennings he's got a job for him, but it's going to take 2 years, maybe three.
It's impossible. You can't do it. I mean, the longest anyone's ever done is 8 weeks. I know because it was me.
Well, yeah, with the old burn 'em out method, we'll learn Rethrick has come up with a chemical method for memory eradication. It's far more civilized and allows for longer periods of memory deletion. My first question, if I were Michael, would be, who are they testing all this stuff on? Have they really run a 2-year test?
Assuming it were possible, would you do it?
Seems pretty iffy to me. 2 years is a long time. Rethrick even hints it might be three.
What's the job, Jimmy?
Can't tell you. Other than to say that it involves optics.
Jennings is hesitant, but Rethrick is dangling stock options. He says this could be it.
Give up 3 years of my life?
Not give up. Trade. 3 years in return for the rest of your life. One big paycheck. You're done.
Way to slip in the title of the movie there, Jimmy. Rethrick is pitching hard. He says he will guarantee Jennings 8 figures. 8? I couldn't even picture that. I had to write it out. He's meaning more than $10 million. Actually, it turns out to be a lot more. Jennings is replaying the conversation back at his apartment. Literally, we can hear his internal thoughts.
You're rich beyond your wildest dreams. One big paycheck. You're done.
Okay, Aaron, we got it. The name of the movie is Paycheck. How could Jennings pass up stock options? He goes for it. We cut to a helicopter landing at the Rethrick compound. Amazingly, we are 20 minutes into a John Woo movie, and this is our first helicopter. Jennings is greeted by the very officious-looking John Wolfe, played by Colm Feore. The whole check-in is fairly predictable, nothing in or out without it being screened. Jennings also has to surrender his personal belongings, including his watch, wallet.
Sorry, those two.
Even his sunglasses are confiscated. There's a hilarious bit of product placement in this scene. One of the things Jennings takes out of his pockets is a very noticeable packet of Altoids strips. Strips, you might be saying? Yeah, don't go looking for them today. Altoid strips had just been introduced in 2003. As the name implies, they were these paper-thin strips designed to dissolve on your tongue with the same great minty taste of the curiously strong regular Altoids. I don't recall all the benefits of the strips. I think it was fewer calories, more convenience, and fits better in your pocket. Whatever it was, no one was sold on the idea. In spite of this stellar movie placement, Altoid strips were a misfire and later discontinued. After the check-in, Jennings is taken to Rethrick's hyper-power CEO office.
Mike! Hey! You made it!
Yeah.
It's about half an acre with a marble floor, granite top desk, and concrete spans overhead with skylights. You don't even have to ask. This is definitely the office of the CEO. Once Jennings has his seat, Wolf pulls out a massive injection gun. It looks like something you'd use to vaccinate a horse or maybe an elephant.
What is this?
We find out it's for the memory wipe.
We inject you with an isotope. It migrates to your brain, lodges, serves as a marker. Then when we're done, another injection erases everything back to the marker.
Boy, this sure sounds way too easy. It's also putting Shorty out of a job.
No barbaric cooking of the brain.
Well, yeah, but the isotope injection also looks a bit barbaric, and I'm still wondering, who were the test subjects for this tech? We cut to the Allcom research and development floor. There's more hilarious dated tech at the open of this scene. One of the researchers zips by on a 2-wheeled Segway scooter. The Segway had been introduced by inventor Dean Kamen in 2001 to a fairly ho-hum reception. After years of trying to get anyone to love this thing, Kamen would sell the company in 2015. You still see a few mall security guys on them, and there are still a few city tours conducted on Segways, but fewer all the time. The 2-wheeled self-balancing scooter would be phased out of production by 2020. The testing and research area is a hive of activity. It almost feels chaotic. Plants are somehow being grown in this underground bunker. Touchscreens and modern-looking testing equipment is scattered all over the place. Water-filled columns might be growing strains of seaweed. Flowers are floating in open pools of water. Allcom, which initially presented as a tech company, seems to be into everything. Rethrick is called away. As Jennings is looking around, a sudden windstorm blows up. We see the close-up of a hand on a controller. This is a created whirlwind. Jennings is in the middle of it. He shouts, "I give up," and the wind subsides. A robotic hand appears in front of his face, holding a flower. We cut to a smiling Rachel Porter.
"Don't give up."
"Uma, you jokester." Her windstorm most certainly ruined several different experiments happening in that room, but hey, everybody got a chuckle out of it. Jennings is obviously smitten. He sheepishly apologizes for his piggish behavior at the party. He's really a nice guy. He just gets like that sometimes. Uma gives him a slow turn, slow burn look over glossed lips, slightly parted, willowy, shaggy hair framing her face. The music tells us Jennings is head over heels and Rachel is into it. The movie's only 2 hours. There's no time to waste when it comes to getting these two together. We've got R&D to get back to. Jennings rubs his arm, reminding us everything happening to him right now is going to be ripped away at some point. Rethrick leads Jennings to an inner sanctum, a secure area inside the already secure lab space. A man is standing at a table with a briefcase. Rethrick introduces him as the other half of Jennings' development team. This is William Decker.
"Gentlemen, let's have a look at the next 3 years of your lives."
Rethrick opens the briefcase to reveal dazzling white light. The camera moves into the light and we go into a whiteout transition. Coming out of the bright white screen, we're back in Rethrick's office.
"What happened?"
"Michael, you're done."
Wolf is also in the room. He's reholstering the elephant vaccination gun we met back in the isotope scene. The brain wipe has happened, and like any good severed worker making the transition, Jennings' Audi is a bit disoriented. This is where the movie meets up with the novella. Everything to this point in the movie has been extrapolation from the scriptwriters. They had to illustrate how Jennings did his job, the dangers, and the upsides. We, as viewers, are now experts on this brain wipe project plan, so we'll understand the stakes from here on out. Changing the process from burning to chemical seemed a little weird. Why prep us on the one method only to make a change for the next job? I guess understanding the basic procedure at all is necessary for us to buy in to the next steps Jennings takes. Michael wants to know how long he's been gone.
"It's been 3 years, Mike."
"How'd I do?"
"You did good."
Jennings is told to go home, do the paperwork, and show up at Ready Grant & Associates the next day for his paycheck. Everything in Jennings' apartment is covered with sheets. I'm not sure when he got around doing that, since he was only home for like 8 hours before going to Rethrick's lab. Must have been right before hopping the helicopter, or maybe he had Shorty do it. Voiceover from the office meeting continues as Michael has a seat at his computer. He logs into something called a stock analyzer and checks the share price for Alcom. In what must be a nod to Philip K. Dick, instead of 50,000 credits, Jennings was given 50,000 shares. The stock analyzer says Alcom had a starting value of $40 in December of 2003. This would make Rethrick a cheapskate. Mr. Eight Figures only deposited $2 million in the account, counting on growth. He was very adamant about things going up during their initial meeting. This is where his predictions have to pan out or Jennings gets screwed. Jennings hits a button to track the performance of the stock. It was a mover. There was an 8-way split from a high of 160 back to 20 per share. Suddenly, he's got 400,000 shares of stock, and they are all climbing. Another 2-way split now gives him 800,000 shares. The 2-way split is shown as happening on May 31st of 2007. Hold on a minute. That would mean he was in there longer than 3 years. May of 2007 is 3 years and 6 months since December 23rd of 2003 when he went in. And May wasn't even the end of his term. He worked past that. We aren't given the current date, but as of the day he's checking, the portfolio contains 800,000 shares at a closing price of $115.02. The total valuation of the portfolio is $92,016,000. This means the value of Allcom has increased 46 times in the past 4 years or so. Jim Cramer must have had an aneurysm recommending it. If Jennings could really see into the future, he'd move it all to cash in order to avoid the 2008 housing bust. Interesting little game they played with the dates. Jennings is released from his monitor gig on December 22nd. He goes to Rethrick's party that night, then checks into Rethrick's lab the next day on December 23rd. The movie was released on Christmas Day, December 25th of 2003, so the viewer feels like it's all happening right then. They did miss a trick here. If they wanted to give another nod to PKD, they could have rolled the action back a week to December 16th. That's his birthday.
$92 million.
Jennings is looking at the stock analyzer and cackling wildly, showing off Ben Affleck's non-whitened 2003 teeth. The hyper-whitening craze that took over Hollywood hadn't really kicked in just yet. Oh, and a quick aside that had to stick in Batman's craw. Affleck wasn't the first choice for this role. It was originally offered to fellow Good Will Hunting scribe Matt Damon. Damon turned it down. Matt may have read the script and realized this was going to be a dud. Even though Affleck publicly thanked him for passing on the role, it's clear Damon dodged a major bullet. Damon does sign on for another Dick story when he stars in the 2011 movie The Adjustment Bureau. It has held up better over time with a tomato meter score of 71%, easily doubling Paycheck's numbers. Affleck was awarded a Golden Raspberry for his portrayal of Michael Jennings. Then again, Ben was busy picking up Golden Raspberries in 2003. He also got one for his work in Geely and as Matt Murdock in Daredevil, giving him the hat trick for the year. You'd think he'd have learned his lesson, but no, in 2004, he also appeared in Jersey Girl and Surviving Christmas. Even with all of those career disasters, he has somehow managed to have a pretty decent career. Moving behind the camera to directing and producing has helped. We cut to the quite impressive office building of Reddy Grant and Associates. A Northwest Taxi Company cab drops Jennings out front. We are, by the way, in Seattle, the cradle of tech on the West Coast at the turn of the century. Jennings is seated at a glass conference table across from a pretty but serious female representative of Reddy Grant. No hanky-panky in the boardroom for Michael this meeting. He is ready to start cashing out those shares and living a life of leisure from here on. This is when he gets some unexpected news.
Mr. Jennings, you forfeited your shares.
What now? He wouldn't do that. He has no memory of doing that.
Yeah, here. Dated 4 weeks ago.
Sometimes it's like Michael's forgotten that he was forced to forget. It's funny to me how everything in the movie has to be amped up just a bit. In the book, he was working for only 2 years instead of three, and he made the changeover to Trinkets 2 weeks ago instead of four. Also, he's given himself 19 or possibly 20 Trinkets in the movie, where he only had seven in the book. It is a Hollywood mantra. If you want something to be better, make it bigger.
Why would I do that? I wouldn't do that. It doesn't make sense. This is a mistake has been made. It needs to be corrected.
Jennings can't deny that is his signature. He goes into a monologue about the stupidity of giving up $92 million in stock options compared to the relative value of this stuff in the envelope.
No one would do that. This doesn't make sense. I mean, unless you think this is a $40 million can of hairspray, which is pink. And this is a $100 million book of matches. I mean, you know, I've been a little out of it for a couple of years. I don't know, is this back in style now? Are these $100 million sunglasses? Am I missing something?
Is that a Golden Raspberry level performance? Yeah, I'd say so. I do love the inclusion of this monologue, bad as it is, because this was the driving premise that inspired PKD to write the story. He said in interviews about the book, he was fascinated with the idea how a bus token is usually only worth 50 cents, unless you don't have one and you really need one. At those moments, something as mundane and common as a bus token or a book of matches can become priceless. If you could look into the future and see where one of those gotta-have-it kinds of scenarios unfolds, you'd make sure to carry a bus token or a half dollar with you. This scene also includes the incredibly heavy-handed mention of the stamps.
Your personal items?
Yes?
You only needed 4 stamps.
Oh, well, guess I could afford the extra 50 cents.
So you know there's something about one of those stamps. Jennings doesn't realize it because he's still raging about losing out on $90 million. And of course, they're Albert Einstein commemorative stamps. Anytime you start messing with time travel, you've got to throw in a nod to Uncle Albert. I'd say including a reference to the rather quaint United States Postal Service as a deliverer of packages is also dating this movie. In 2023, he'd have FedExed or UPSed those trinkets to Reddy Grant. One of the things neither PKD nor this movie addresses is why he has to choose either one or the other. In the book, he foregoes 50,000 credits to instead take the envelope full of trinkets. Same here. He dumped the $90 million in stocks so he could have the envelope. I don't understand the either-or nature of the transaction. Why couldn't he have taken the cash but also thrown in a packet of trinkets? In the movie, Jennings says he must have given up the money so he would pay attention to the trinkets. I think my attention could have been had for less than $90 million. Maybe give back $10 million in exchange for the envelope. In the book, it sounds more like the only way to get the trinkets out is to, in effect, trade them for the credits. The book's Kelly character even says Jennings is not the only bag of trinkets she's handed over to NDA workers. Things start to move pretty fast right about here. Don't get too hung up on logic or physics. Jennings storms out of the Reddy Grant conference room saying he'll need to make some calls. He left the envelope of stuff on the table. Cut to him making a call from his apartment. As he's trying to get Jimmy Rethrick on the phone, he notices the door to his apartment is standing open. That's weird. The Red Sox fan, of course, has a baseball bat handy. He uses it to take down an armed FBI agent who's hiding in his kitchen. More FBI guys try to restrain Jennings. It's not until one of them pulls out a taser before they're able to stop him. Cut to the FBI offices. The first thing they show us is the clock on the wall. It's 5 minutes until 3 p.m. Jennings is now seated in a weird dentist-slash-torture chair being interrogated by more recognizable actors. Hey, it's Dexter. That's Michael C. Hall growling about Jennings getting fried for being a traitor. The team leader is stellar New York actor Joe Morton. Morton seems to have been genetically engineered to play either a cop or an attorney. He's fantastic in about anything he does. I don't even hold it against him that he's the one who launched Skynet and set the table for the rise of the Terminators. Joe is truly that good. He ultimately caused the downfall of humanity, but I still enjoy watching him.
Listen, guys, a mistake has been made here, all right? I'm not a traitor, I'm an engineer.
A reverse engineer, right?
They want to know what Jennings was working on for the past 3 years. In the book, the SP wants to know where he was working for the last 2 years. When Jennings left Reddy Grant, he must have grabbed his envelope of stuff because the FBI has it sitting there on a table in the interrogation room. If no one had grabbed the envelope, we wouldn't have much of a story. Jennings denies the stuff in the envelope is even his. Dexter grabs the watch in the mix of trinkets and roughly puts it on Jennings' wrist. It fits perfectly and exactly covers his watch tan lines. Unlike Severance Innies, Jennings seems to have enjoyed quite a bit of that famous Seattle sunshine during his tenure with Alcom. A slide of Jennings' workmate, Decker, comes up on the screen. He's the guy we met for 2 seconds right before Rethrick opened the briefcase full of white light. They tell him Decker was a contractor for the government, but his project got shelved. He then sold out to the highest bidder. The government thinks the buyer was Rethrick. They'd be interrogating Decker right now, but
Decker died. Natural causes.
natural being gravity after a 140-foot fall out of his apartment building.
Patent applications have been filed within the last month based on Decker's work. The signature on those patent applications? Now, surely, refiners, you must know it's Michael Jennings who signed those apps, or at least his innie did. His Audi has no memory of it. John Woo might be ADHD. He can't let anything sit still. His movies are like visual fidget spinners. As the FBI is interrogating Jennings, for some reason, he is slowly turning in the dentist chair. Every time we cut to him, he's spinning. The guys interrogating him are standing on either side of the chair. Their comments ping-pong back and forth to counter the spin. It keeps the scene moving, and I guess it is visually interesting, but if you think about what's happening, it's a little strange. After shouting his memory was wiped and he can't remember the last 3 years, Joe steps on a foot pedal. The chair stops spinning.
We figured Rethrick might have tried a wipe, so we'll try an extraction.
You're not going to say anything. I'm telling you, waste your time.
The FBI must know about the use of brain wipes by major corporations. Jennings is immediately restrained in the chair, and a brain scanner is pulled into place over his head. It looks a lot like the one Shorty was using after the 3D monitor gig. It even has the same temperature readout on the screen. The temp immediately jumps to over 40, so we know these guys don't give a damn about rendering Michael a veg. They're scanning his neural pathways. The chemical wipe seems to have left some residue. They scan through a few disjointed and fuzzy memories, but nothing is really coherent. One of the items in Jennings' envelope is a pack of Spirit cigarettes. I'm not a smoker, I've never been a smoker, but I've always had the impression Spirits are a bargain basement cheapo brand of smokes. I'm not sure if this is product placement. The pack says these are Spirit Lakes. The next scene is clunky. Okay, it's supposed to be mid-2007. This means it's about a year before the passage of the Indoor Clean Air Act. But still, we're in a government office building. Joe Morton's character, Agent Dodge, is wrung out after the intense interrogation and the failed brain scan. He says he needs a smoke and appears to be leaving the room. The unnamed agent who was going through Jennings' envelope speaks up.
Boss, he won't mind.
He tosses the pack of spirits to Morton. As Joe shakes a butt out of the pack, it's in slow motion. This must be important. We get a close-up of Agent Dodge lighting the cig. Quick cut to Jennings, still locked down in the dentist chair. He's recovering and sweaty after the failed scan. Agent Dodge takes a hard pull on the lit spirit. We see smoke dancing around his mouth in close-up when he exhales. Hey, remember how Rethrick turned off the fire alarm before they had cigars in his office? Joe should have done the same thing. I don't know if he just took up smoking or if this is the first time he's ever smoked inside, but for some reason, he gives no thought to the fire alarms. He releases a big, satisfying cloud of smoke. He blows it right at the sensor. Not even the stellar Joe Morton can sell this scene. He starts waving his hands at the smoke, realizing he's about to set off the alarms, which he does. The room is suddenly bathed in red light. Alarms are blaring and some kind of fire suppression mist is being jetted down from the ceiling. The computers turn off and the restraints on Michael's chair retract. Visibility is almost nil in the room. When they realize Jennings is loose, Dexter says to cover the door. Morton isn't worried. He figures Jennings can't go anywhere because he can't see. Jennings runs to the desk and grabs this weird pair of flip-up sunglasses, which were included in his trinket packet.
Are these $100 million sunglasses? Am I missing something?
Amazingly, these glasses allow for a clear view through fog. Glasses like this don't exist, as far as I know, but they aren't out of the realm of possibility in the future. A team at UCLA School of Engineering and Applied Science were working on just this kind of item in 2007. I couldn't find the current status of the project, but glasses that can look through smoke or fog aren't completely magical science. The agents are screaming, "I can't see," and get low to the ground as Jennings makes his way across the room. Since he can see, he's able to get a few solid hits in on the blinded agents. The door is locked, but an agent trying to get in to help opens it, allowing Jennings to stumble out into the hallway. Jennings is straight-arming agents right and left as he makes his way out of the FBI building. On the street, we see Mr. Wolf from Rethrick. He's seated at an outdoor restaurant table enjoying a piece of cherry pie. A close-up on his Kenneth Cole watch tells us it's 3 minutes after three.
Good night, Mikey.
Wolf stands with a satisfied look on his face. As he adjusts his tie, he's stunned to see Michael Jennings emerge from the FBI building at a full run. Jennings ducks into the interurban bus terminal. The FBI agents are only 40 or 50 feet behind him. Wolf witnesses the whole thing, but decides not to follow Mikey into the terminal. Jennings is taking out pedestrians hard, running them down as he barrels through the tunnel. At the turnstiles, Mikey is held up short. If only he had a bus pass. He drops the envelope accidentally, and voila, a bus pass falls out. Good for one day only. Jennings slides the pass through the turnstile just steps ahead of the agents. He runs between two buses and disappears. He, of course, got on a bus, but which one? The agents are left in the middle of the terminal turning circles, and Jennings is gone. Back at Rethrick's place, Aaron Eckert lays out what was supposed to happen.
Michael Jennings died at 3 minutes after three. The government, left with no case, closed its investigation of Allcom.
Ah, that explains the glance to the watch. Wolf somehow knew Jennings was supposed to have died at 3:03.
So you see, it's impossible that he escaped unless you changed something.
I didn't.
Change something? What's he talking about? Like, maybe somebody gave Mikey a bus pass so he could get away? Or put a pack of cigarettes in his envelope so the FBI agent would smoke one and set off the fire alarms?
He left the attorney's office exactly when it predicted. The feds took him exactly when it predicted.
But he didn't die like it predicted.
The "it" they're talking about is a time viewer. It allows the user to see into the future. This is the same thing Jennings invents in the book, only there he does it in 2 years instead of three. It's described in the story as a very precise mirror. Rethrick even told Jennings in their initial meeting it was a project all about optics. The nature of the viewer is drawing from an Albert Einstein prediction that we cannot time travel. Sorry to break it to all you Doc Brown fans, but according to the Big E, nobody gets to bop through history physically, even with a DeLorean. But it might be possible for us to view the future because of the nature of light, time, and the structure of the universe. Use of the time viewer also calls into question the idea of fate. Is the path of the future a set thing, or can it be altered? According to Dick, if you can see the future, you can also change the future. Jennings was able to use his creation to view his own future. He realized these little trinkets, like the bus pass, the sunglasses, could be used to alter his fate. The first thing Jennings uses in the novel is a small piece of fine wire. It's just enough to allow him to short out the locks on the SP Cruiser. He's able to escape. It sounded a bit more plausible and elegant than using cigarette smoke to set off a fire alarm.
Michael Jennings is not a super agent. He's an engineer. Yet somehow he managed to escape from a double-locked room. How? Was it fate? No, fate was on our side. That means someone who knew changed something, and it wasn't me. And if it wasn't you, then who the...
Come on, Jimmy. It's really taking you this long to figure it out? I'm shocked he calls himself Michael's friend. He's a pretty cold and calculating bastard here. Jimmy and Wolf run down to the time machine room. It's the same room where we met Decker, only now it's got this very cool time viewer machine built in it. Jimmy jumps into the control space and fires it up. He immediately gets an error message. Well, of course, Michael bugged the software so it won't work for anyone else. If it did, they'd be able to see how he was planning to use his bag of goodies, and they'd be able to stop him. Okay, Refiners, this is where we're going to leave this movie. From here on out, it's a lot less like Severance and a lot more like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Remember how Bill and Ted would time travel to leave things laying around, like car keys to find later when they needed them? This is pretty much what Jennings is doing with his bag of stuff, only without the laughs or George Carlin. Each item becomes a surprisingly valuable key, which takes us to the next piece of the puzzle. It's kind of fun to see how Jennings utilizes each item, but a lot of it is rote. He's got 20 of them to get through. I found myself counting items to see how many were left. Not a good sign, especially in an action movie. I will give you a couple of huge spoilers from the movie, just in case you don't want to go watch it. The time viewer gets destroyed. Ta-da! Both Uma and Affleck realize knowing the future is dangerous because if people know it, they'll try to change it. The Albert Einstein stamp is important. It contains a micro dot showing future headlines about a preemptive nuclear strike. Why would anyone unleash a preemptive nuclear strike? Because the machine predicted a war. The nuclear strike was supposed to stop the war. Trying to change the future turns out to be far more damaging than not knowing it to begin with. Also, spoiler number two, Jennings does get both his payday and the girl. He cribbed lotto numbers from the future and bought a ticket using the numbers he was able to see. It scored him $90 million, so basically the same amount he gave up. In the end, he, Uma, and Giamatti are all able to live happily ever after on the lotto proceeds. So that's a quick look at Paycheck, both the movie and short story. It's one of the origin stories which led Dan Erickson to the creation of Severance. If you want to experience the movie for yourself, it is available to stream on the Paramount Plus app. You can also rent it through Amazon Prime. As I said, it's not great, but there are some big names involved and good action set pieces courtesy of John Woo. If you want a better representation of the story and more insight into the character of Jennings, I highly recommend you check out the original novella. It is also available on Amazon in a collection of many of Dick's most famous short stories. Remember, it was written in 1952. Adjust your expectations accordingly. Okay, refiners, since we both know how important it is to preserve the work-life balance, I'd say it's time for you to go. We're done for the day. We are still in a holding pattern on Severance, waiting for the announcement of Season 2. I don't have a time viewer, but I do have a good feeling about what's coming. Stay positive, refiners, and I'll talk to you again soon. Now, if you could exit via the elevator, and remember, please, stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate Severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.